Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
It's all happening. It's all happening. This is going to be amazing.
Holy cow. Oh, here we are. Hello.
Hello.
All right. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. And welcome. I'm very excited about this week's Make Me Smart, the podcast where we get smarter about tech, economics, and culture together.
Together.
Because none of us is as smart as all of us. Together.
Together.
Doing
together.
It all together.
So we are doing this week, we're gonna reveal part of the reporting that Ms. Wood did while she was absent from this particular podcast for the last number of weeks. It is the big UN Climate Change Summit coming up in New York beginning of next week, right?
Yep, Monday,
the
23rd.
Mm-hmm. And Molly has been out reporting on climate change and technology just for that, right?
Pretty much. So we have been doing this series, not just for that. So we've been doing this series on the other show, Marketplace Tech, about how and whether the technology world can help us adapt to climate change, Silicon Valley's role. So I was down doing a bunch of reporting on the money part and the tech part and the community part. And we've, you know, been watching, obviously, the climate conversation get a lot more urgent. And I went down there partly because having been immersed in this industry for some 20 years and watching all of these companies come along and say, I know, right? Old. Hecka old. But having watched these companies for so many years come and go and say, we can save the world and we're mission driven and we no problem is too big and hack everything and disrupt this and that. I keep sitting here being like, great. I have a good big problem for you to solve. It's a hairy one.
Right.
When you get in on it.
And that's the really interesting thing about these companies, right? Because their, you know, mission statements basically are fix all these big hairy problems. And yet they haven't really taken on this one. So that's what we're going to explore today with some of the reporting Molly did last week. Talk about financing and adapting for climate change, how it might happen, where it might come from, all kinds of good stuff. But also, you like putting us on the ground down there, right?
Yes. So part of this was to go to Silicon Valley, which, you know, we'd say in some of these pieces is not just like a metaphor or a metonym for the tech industry.
It's a
place, and it's a place on the coast, and it's a place with sort of this community, East Palo Alto, that has this very high poverty rate, that suffers a huge lack of good jobs and public services, and is it's like a microcosm of what's happening in the real world. Here is this community without advantages that is also one of the most vulnerable to sea level rise right there in Silicon Valley. And it's going to flood first. And then right next door, I mean, literally, you're just driving along and 1 minute you're in East Palo Alto and the next minute you're in Palo Alto, which, like, the difference could not be more stark. And so we ended up doing some sort of accidental wealth tourism on our little drive with producer Stephanie Hughes and audio engineer Ben Tolliday. And so you're going to hear, we basically just started as we were driving through downtown Palo Alto, looking up home prices in real time to just see that difference.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny.
You know, I'm trying to find, like, what exact neighborhood we're in. Let's see. We've just come off University Avenue, approaching Crescent Park, kind of near downtown Palo Alto. And things have changed dramatically from East Palo Alto. All of the power lines are buried. There are no big, huge transformers. There's no bars on windows or fences in front of houses. It's all Audis and, like, perfectly manicured lawns. let's see, we're passing a house for sale by appointment only. It doesn't have my favorite thing, which is the URL, but I kind of want to look it up because I'm guessing, I mean, these are all, without question, multi-million dollar houses. It's a tree-lined street. We're, for all intents and purposes, we're in Beverly Hills.
It is. It has changed. Really.
Isn't it a complete change? Yeah. Like, we made that one left-hand turn onto Lincoln Avenue, and it's just, like, a whole new world.
We just passed a $13 million house.
Is that what it was?
Did you look at it now? So the one I thought was six was probably 13.
$13 million.
Wow, so that was Ben there. Was Ben in the back seat doing the
Ben was in the back seat on Redfin. Yeah. Yep, yeah. Just looking up houses.
Yeah, $13 million.
And then we started playing a game where every time we saw a Tesla, we just yelled ding, and then it got too annoying.
But then you stop, right? Because there are freaking Teslas all over the place. Yeah. So
yeah, it was insane.
So take us the rest of the way here. What else did you do? And I guess what are the answers, solutions? I don't even know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that is appropriate to our show here, Make Me Smart, and just in general, is that, you know, at the end of the day, if we're going to survive this thing, we're going to need money. We're going to need funding. And so we went to Silicon Valley and asked the venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road what they're doing. But we also came back to Oakland to talk to this guy, Danny Kennedy, who is fascinating. You are going to notice an Australian accent as we take this conversation a little more global. Just letting you know. Danny Kennedy worked for Greenpeace all around the world. He's super interesting. He started a solar power company called Sungevity, and now he runs New Energy Nexus, which is like a startup incubator, basically, for clean energy entrepreneurs, but all over the world. So it operates in California, China, Southeast Asia, East Africa. And I talked to him about what it's going to take to actually finance these big changes that we're going to need to essentially remake the economy, right, with climate change in mind. We started out with the fact that a lot of venture capitalists are not funding climate science right now. They all feel like, or climate tech, they all feel like they lost a lot of money 10 or 15 years ago on companies like Sungevity. And they aren't sure that the returns are there now. So we started off by talking with Danny Kennedy about how this company, New Energy Nexus, is a nonprofit and why that is.
We are a nonprofit. So we're a bit of a weird beast. 501 VC is the gag. But really, we're a mission-based organization who sees entrepreneurs as kind of critical agents of change in the climate crisis. We have to grow a lot of businesses to deliver the energy transition and electricity and mobility services to decarbonize the economy. But we do that with a kind of justice-forward perspective because we think that we need to do that anyway, and it's also the way to maintain the political momentum of change.
Tell me more about the justice-forward aspect. Is it a screening criteria for you?
Absolutely. You know, we want to ensure that more women and minorities are leading these companies, are benefiting from ownership of these companies and the growth and potential of them, the opportunities for jobs in their communities, but also, you know, the benefits of equity and ownership. And so here in California, for example, how that shows up is we try to ensure our companies are not just the sort of white guys out of Stanford and Cal that Sand Hill Road prefers by the numbers. We go to the Central Valley and we beat the bushes in Imperial County and we find the cool ideas that are coming up there, which are just as innovative, in fact, if not more. And then even more so overseas, you know, these emerging economies that are dealing with the first impacts of the climate crisis are also coming up with fantastic ideas and innovations and need the support that they, you know, aren't probably going to get unless folk like us go and find them.
I think there is this sense in the Bay Area and in Silicon Valley that all the good ideas and all the good innovations and all the entrepreneurs and all the funding come from here, and that that could also be applied to climate. And I really want to get your perspective on how, you know, the most important work seems to be happening elsewhere and has to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that sense. You're correct that people have high opinions of their own brilliance in this town and this state. And some of that is deserved, to give credit to the innovators that have come up here and done things that have obviously impacted our lives and lifestyles over the last decades. But they sometimes forget where they come from, actually, and the background of Department of Defense support that engendered the technologies that they're now monetizing and commercializing and so forth anyway. But beyond that, they're clearly missing some things, right? When, you know, you have 96% of venture capital going to white men, you're leaving half the population off the table in the form of women. You know, you're missing all of the invention that comes out of adversity of people of color in this country and around the world who come up with great ideas because of their life experience. And so, you know, we're fooling ourselves if we think all the good ideas are here. And we have evidence that that is not true, and we see great ideas coming up in Indonesia and Thailand and Nigeria and Uganda and elsewhere, which is not surprising at all, particularly as the world globalizes and people connect and have the benefits of the internet to work with and the online sharing of knowledge and business models and finance and commerce, as you know we do. So it's really exciting times, but you got to keep your eye on the prize, which is the next billion in Asia and Africa, the fact that, you know, half the world's middle class population from 2020 will be in Asia. 20 of the largest 30 cities are in Asia. And as the world urbanizes, you know, they're clearly going to be coming up with the urban smart city solutions in Asia, not in San Francisco, which clearly is not a very smart city if you walk the streets.
So does it matter to some extent if what we think of now as big tech, if what we think of as the most powerful companies in the world or Sand Hill Road, does it matter if they do not meaningfully engage in innovating around climate?
Yeah, of course it matters. Everyone should meaningfully engage in innovating around climate. And we overhype venture capital in this country and this state and this city. We think it's very significant. 0.5% of American businesses receive venture capital. So if a third of that comes from Sand Hill Road, so what? I mean, you know, like as a class of asset managers, these guys are failures. They have not delivered returns to their LPs better than the market for over a decade. There are some funds that have done very well. We know the names. They're Hallowed, Kleiner and Sequoia and a few others. Whether their ethics are any good is an entirely different conversation, of course. But, you know, let's not pretend the venture capital model is actually delivering either for its investors or for the community, firstly. And then, you know, yes, they should be moving money in the direction of important, meaningful change in society that serves communities. Absolutely.
So this is a little bit like philosophical. But on the one hand, there's a part of me that thinks, like, why don't we have a Manhattan Project for climate? Right? Like, why isn't somebody, why can't Google just say, like, hey, we got all the money in the world. We're going to get everybody on board. We're going to like create a thing and just make it a widget in our X factory. Like, ultimately, when you look at the idea of us all getting on a war footing, is there any entity that can lead that? Or does it really truly have to be like a million seeds planted in every country and every city?
I think it has to be a greater number than a smaller number. It's very unlikely there's a silver bullet here. There's a silver buckshot or several silver buckshots. And what we're trying to do is spawn the engines that support the thousand flowers to bloom in a thousand places, because the world is big and diverse and vast. And I mean, my view, to answer your sort of philosophic question, is that widget has actually been invented. It's called the solar panel. That there is an answer. We need to stop boiling water to create electricity, and we need to use this thing that America invented in 1954 at AT&T's Bell Labs called the silicon cell. It's a very clever machine. When sunlight falls on it, it creates electricity. That's magic. Like, you know, in the sense that Arthur C. Clarke talked about a good technology, it's so cool, it feels like magic. This happens. We have them in the world in all sorts of applications. We need now to put them in every application. So the war footing is more about, we don't need to invent a gun. We've got the gun and we know what the bullets are. We need the Lend-Lease Act and the formation of massive pools of capital and a president who's going to get on the phone and call Ford and say, stop making cars, start making tanks. That's what the war footing was. And if we were serious about entrepreneurs spreading solar and storage and the solutions we have and the few others that we need yet to invent, and we would start deploying capital at the scale that only states can, actually. I mean, I think when Shenzhen put 17,000 buses on the road in a year and electrified their fleet, that changed everything. And the internal combustion engine, which Detroit made famous, is gone in a decade. And American businesses don't see that yet, but it's dead. And we need to move with that, if only to save our jobs and, you know, portfolios as pension holders and things, but also because there's huge opportunity in that change.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Hit me.
So a couple of things.
Yeah.
And I'm going to, so let's remember I was a history major. right? And that whole thousand, yes. That whole thousand flowers blooming thing?
Yep.
Remember that? Okay.
Yep.
That's actually a bastardization of Chairman Mao, who said, let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools of thought contend. He said it in the mid-1950s in China, and it was used as a precursor to a crackdown on intellectuals and critics of the regime. Now, why do I say that? Number one, because I just think history is interesting. But number two, be careful what you wish for, right? Because there's all kinds of, yes, this is amazing possibilities out there, much as the internal combustion engine was whenever it was invented, that maybe haven't worked out. So there's that, right? Number one. Number two, and let's just be clear, this is the first time I'm hearing this interview, I think the guy kind of ducked and said, oh man, so what, Silicon Valley? We can't, or San Jose Road, we can't do anything about this. We're teeny tiny. Dude, man, shut up.
Wait. I'm sorry, wait, who can't, what?
So this guy said, and maybe I heard it wrong, he basically was like, Sand Hill Road and venture capitalists, we're a tiny slice of all the money out there. We can't really do anything. How, you know?
They are. They, he is
right,
not from Sand Hill.
Sorry, they,
let's
right?
Let's be super clear.
Got it. He is not from Sand Hill Road.
He was saying, no. So he's saying, yes, they need to meaningfully engage, but we cannot rely on them because relatively speaking, it's a tiny slice of the money out there. Well,
yes, okay. So which gets me back to my point. First of all, yes, thank you for the correction. Number two, if John Doerr and Fred Wilson and take your pick, big name venture capitalists came out and said, we are only going to invest in green companies or green whatever. We need leadership on this issue, right? And it has to come from somewhere.
Oh, we absolutely do.
It has to come
from
somewhere.
And it's not coming
from there. And it has to come from the guys with the money or the ladies with the money. But there are more guys with money.
Okay. Well, what he's saying is go out into the world and find the ladies with money or give some money to people, including ladies, who can do this. Because the fact is that Sand Hill Road, which, John Doerr famously said that climate investment is the best opportunity of the century, but then had to spin out a green fund from Kleiner Perkins because they didn't, didn't get the returns.
And that was this morning
on
tech,
And that was this morning on tech, but said essentially, like, this isn't it. We can't make the returns in the 10-year cycle to make this a meaningful part of our core investment strategy, which is fundamentally the problem and why you don't have the leadership. Now, we're getting closer. Like, last week, actually, at long last, like, Bill Gates and Ban Ki-moon said, okay, it's time to turn our attention to adaptation. And if we spend $1.8 trillion, which, a lot of money over the next decade in five key areas. And that's where you have Danny Kennedy saying this is state level money, $1.8 trillion, that will lead to $7.1 trillion in benefits.
So
the reason I went to Silicon Valley was to be like, are you guys going to lead? And to be honest, they were sort of like, no.
Yeah. So.
So then we went to Danny Kennedy to say, who else is going to? And he said, I mean, look, it's going to have to come from a lot of places. Yeah. And yes, ideally someone should.
Yeah. So two things.
It's not them.
$1.8 trillion is only a little bit more than the Trump administration and the GOP's tax cut of 2017, which was $1.5 trillion over 10 years. So you're right, that money is state level, but, you know, we're spending that money anyway. Number two is, I don't think any of this happens, actually, without the leadership of the United States and the president of the United States. And unless and until you have a president of the United States who's going to do a John Kennedy at Rice University, why do we go to the moon? Not because it is easy, but because it is hard. Until you have somebody give him one of those speeches, we're just twiddling our thumbs.
Well, that's depressing because we're out of time. I mean, I would argue that if this is where we are now, then we're going to have to do it without the leadership of the United States because...
Yeah. That may well be, but then it just becomes exponentially harder.
I guess. I mean, I think, you know, I think what the point of the interview we just played was, is that I hopefully, and like maybe we can leave aside the flowers thing, which is clearly problematic, as well as my ongoing metaphor of the Manhattan Project, both problematic examples. It seems like in some ways the best we can hope for is that, look, there are countries all over the world like East Palo Alto, right, that are the most at risk right now.
Right.
And he pointed out, like, if Indonesia, for example, where only a small percentage of people have electricity, he's like, the current plan is for everybody to come online with diesel generators. And if that happens, we all cook, right? We all boil. Yeah. And so that the solutions, if necessity is the mother of saving our asses— then maybe the places where it's needed the most will be the most innovative and the most feel the urgency the most. Because we clearly don't here in the U.S.
Ideally, I mean, yes. But if I'm living... But if I'm living in Indonesia and I don't have electricity and I can get it by firing up a diesel generator, give me the switch, baby.
Absolutely.
Right.
Which is why you need like the startup,
right,
you know, that can come and say, actually, I have the solar panel
funded
for you.
By,
it's free.
Funded by VCs from Sand Hill Road. Anyway, just to bring it full circle.
That would be great. You can come on my next tour and be like, come on, guys. They funded companies that buy and sell used cars.
Yeah.
It's a long play for them.
It's a series on Marketplace Tech that Molly is doing called How We Survive. Check it out. There's some good stuff. There's some really good stuff.
Yeah, we'll be doing all week is the reporting, and we'll end on Monday, the day of the UN climate change thing, with an interview with the California governor, Gavin Newsom.
Mr. Newsom.
Mm-hmm.
Very well.
Or as I like to call him, Batman.
Really?
He looks like Bruce Wayne, and he talks like Batman. I'm just saying, I know this is not the most professional observation, but it's true.
Noted.
Tell us what you think
about Gavin Newsom or Batman. Think Gavin Newsom
looks and sounds like Batman. Or if you have thoughts about climate change, big tech, what Sand Hill Road should or should not be doing, how we adapt.
Yeah.
I feel like I know you're going to have thoughts, and we want to hear them.
Yes.
So leave us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We will take your emails also, but we love a voice memo.
We prefer voicemails.
Now we're going to take a short break. We're going to cool down, deep breaths, and then we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
We're back. Me and Molly Wood.
I'm finally here. I won't leave you hanging again.
Well, you probably will, you know.
We pretty much had to do this episode just to explain what on earth.
Yeah, why I was alone. I was all alone.
Where'd she go?
All right. You want to go first or you want me to go first?
I want you to go first because I see your link in here and I'm excited.
Well, it's the continuing banana pants story. Somebody at WeWorks or maybe their banks or maybe SoftBank, which owns a chunk of that company, said, you are not going public. Get out of here. That's ridiculous. You're worth a third of what you thought, maybe a quarter, and you have terrible corporate governance. And oh, look, the We Company IPO is going to be, probably will be, postponed. And I just I raise it for a couple of things. Number one, so I can say banana pants on this podcast in tribute and homage to my partner Ms. Wood. Also, just to point out that it's really interesting what's happening with IPOs now, right? There is increased scrutiny. There is a distinct lowering of expectations. See also Uber. And maybe a little bit of the bloom is coming off the rose as these companies say, yeah, we want to go public and get all this, you know, access to capital markets and, by the way, make everybody rich. And potential investors say, well, let's have a real close look at that S-1 form that you filed with the SEC talking about your corporate governance structure. And no, you're not going public. That's really interesting.
It is really interesting. And it's a kind of a we have been saying for a while, because, of course, there's so much money around. There's so much private capital. There's so much SoftBank. Mm-hmm. And then these VC funds are raising bigger and bigger funds. Mm-hmm. Not to contradict the point made earlier. But there is a lot of private capital, and it is allowing these companies to get so big that they're almost like public companies before they even go public.
Right. So,
but
so
what it has done, like we always wonder when that's happening, is it a bubble? And is the bubble going to burst? Because we all have PTS left over from the dot-com bubble of 2001. What is maybe kind of good is that if some of these unicorns go under before they ever hit the public markets, that's then the damage is really contained.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. No, I was literally just writing that down. It's way better that they go bust before they go public, or not bust, but that bubble gets deflated before they go public. Way better.
Yeah, but I do think it's very. I think the whole SoftBank part of this story is fascinating because pressure from SoftBank does seem to be a big part of the reason that WeWork is delaying this IPO. And SoftBank has been throwing money around, propping up all kinds. I mean, it's not like people weren't sitting here saying, hey, SoftBank, you put a lot of money into WeWork, which seems like a dubious investment, but they have to park it. Like Masa-san set a goal when he raised the $100 billion vision fund that the full $100 billion had to be invested in 5 years.
The guy who runs SoftBank,
The guy who runs SoftBank. So you're just shoving money under any mattress you can find at that point.
Right.
I don't know. I just think it's like, it's so distorting and it's so interesting. And now to see SoftBank be like, wait, we have some financial discipline after all.
Maybe
it's
not.
In a whole other kind of banana pants.
For sure. All right, what do you got?
But I'm glad public markets won't be subjected to
that. It's true, right? Because can you imagine if they had gone public at a valuation of $49 billion and then somebody took a look at things and said, oh, wait a minute, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I did see a chart the other day that pointed out that none of the tech unicorns that have gone public recently, Uber, Lyft, Slack, have done that well.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
In public markets.
New day. Maybe.
I am fixating not on the new iPhone, not on the big Apple announcement of the new iPhone, but on the fact that we seem finally today. So today is the day. This is a familiar cycle to any of us in the tech journalism world, which is that today is the day that the Apple embargo lifted so that everybody who got an iPhone early so that they could review it all at once and sell a bunch of phones for Apple.
Deal? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Gotcha. That's why they always all come out on the same day.
Gotcha.
Because it's a sort of brilliant PR manipulation
campaign. Yes.
On the part of this company. But I was delighted to see in the New York Times, Brian X. Chen's review of the iPhone, because he started the entire review by saying, at long last, no, you don't need to upgrade.
Hmm.
And in fact, you need to reassess your entire upgrade cycle because you don't need to buy a new one every 1 or 2 years, which is what either Apple or your cell phone company are telling you. And in fact, if you have something as new as even an iPhone 7 and it's working fine, why don't you think about keeping that sucker for 5 years?
Wow.
And you don't need a new one, which is not only, as I'm steeped in climate change coverage, a very environmentally friendly recommendation, but I think a consumer-friendly one too. And it was nice to see a reviewer just kind of like break the hype cycle. I mean, yes, he went on to review the whole thing and talk about it in detail and show all the whatever. But it was great to see like an actual common sense moment in the gadget hype.
That's cool.
Bubble.
That's good.
Yep.
That's good.
Good job, Brian X. Chen.
There you go.
I, for one, will be hanging on to my iPhone X.
We salute you.
Until the last.
All right.
Because it works fine.
Exactly.
It's like the Honda Civic of phones. It's working just fine. Don't need a new one.
I think I have a Honda Civic. Women like an old. No, it's an Accord. Never mind. Never mind. Anyway.
You are not a car guy, man.
No. I used to be. I used to be. My very first car. I'm sure I've said this. My very first car was a 1972 Cullis convertible, red with a white top, 442 engine. It went 1,000 miles an hour in a straight line. Got like 2 miles to the gallon. And then I had a Jaguar. And then I had a Toyota Land Cruiser FJ. Yeah, not the old one, right? Yeah. It used
the
to be total car.
No, like the 70s old, the, one. Or?
Yeah, 1973-ish. Yeah, whatever it was. The worst mistake I ever made in my life actually was selling that Jeep.
You will laugh when I tell you that my lottery car, should I ever just win the lottery and have a chunk of change to spend in a car, is a 1985 Land Cruiser.
Yeah, oh, I believe it.
I just love that truck. Yep. I love it. And then I would like convert it to electric or biodiesel or something because in this scenario, I've won the lottery. Maybe we should move on.
Yes, let's move on. And we're moving on to this, speaking of lotteries and things you can win. It is that time of year, and I'll wrap up the lottery thought in a minute here, where we need your help. We need, frankly, your support and your money, because this is not possible to do without everybody pitching in a little bit. Marketplace.org/donate is where you go for this. And here's the lottery thing. We show up every single week. And Marketplace Tech shows up every day on your radio and your podcast feed. And Marketplace shows up on the air or in your podcast feed. And you kind of win the lottery when that happens because you don't have to support us. You don't have to buy that ticket. We just show up for free. But it's not free to do this. And we need your help. Marketplace.org/donate.
I really like what you did with the lottery thing
that,
there.
Huh? That was totally good. Like on the fly too, because I got myself in a jam and I'm like, well, how am I going to think of a way to get out of this?
That was good. I have to say, I really have been thinking a lot about the incentives of publicly funded media compared to other kinds of media. And I think that you will notice, I hope you will notice the quality. And I hope that you will notice the fact that, you know, our job is to reflect the human beings on the ground, to talk to real people, not to get you to click for whatever reason, not to get you all worked up and scared, but to actually make you smarter. And I frequently feel proud and grateful that I am in public media at this exact moment.
Not like always?
Frequently.
Hello?
I mean out loud. Like out loud, I'm like, man, I'm so glad I work in public media because we get to do the smart stuff. Plus, pencils.
Plus we have stuff. And do you have stuff up there or am I the one with stuff?
This time I didn't get the stuff.
All right, I got the stuff this time.
I got the fanny pack, so.
I know, right? So look, for $5 a month, you can get a Canvas pencil case. I'm going to hold it up. It says, I'm invested in Marketplace, right? And then inside are pencils. Pencils, wait, let me read them to you because they're all embossed with a different thing. I'm invested in Marketplace is one. I've always wondered, which is a thing we do on Marketplace on the radio, is a series.
Good one.
Make me smarter is one.
Smarter?
Yeah. Smarter, yeah. I don't quite understand how that happened. The ER is in parentheses, Tony Wagner says, over the talkback. But
Because we're assuming you're already smart.
Yeah, I'm
it's
opposed.
That's not a typo. It's on purpose. I get it.
And Tony says, look, I didn't make the pencil. I'm just telling you what it says. the stock market is not the economy is one, which I like to say on the radio now and then. This is Marketplace with the three ellipses, which I happen to love. I really appreciate that. I feel heard.
Amazing.
Let's do the numbers. So, So it's six pencils and a pencil case for $5 a month. And I frankly think it's worthwhile. That's all I'm saying.
I think that's amazing. Because our show, this is in the script, and I'm just going to let Tony own this one. Because our shows keep you sharp.
Oh, that's so funny. I was going to skip that.
Oh, no. Never skip the pun.
Wow. And wait, there's a special bonus gift too, which I don't think you have. Do you have the special bonus gift?
I have no gifts this time.
All right. I have the special bonus gift. It's a sticker that says, I'm invested in Marketplace. I should probably do it like this, right? Pretty good.
I love our investor funds. They're so good.
Donate actually in any amount, then you get that little sticker thing. Marketplace.org/donate is where you got to go. And look, here's the other part of this. Hopefully all y'all are cross-pollinated listeners, right? I mean, you do Marketplace Tech, and you do The Morning Show, and you do Marketplace, and you do this podcast, and then you do This Is Uncomfortable with Rima Crace, and then when it comes out, you do The Uncertain Hour with Chrissy Clark and Caitlin Esch. You give us $5. It's not just me and Molly getting the money. Well, we don't get any money. But it's not just this podcast, right? It's the whole smash here at Marketplace, and it's expensive, and we can't do it without you.
And thank you.
Yeah,
and thank you.
And thank you so much for donating.
For real, though. Okay. All right. Your turn to talk.
Okay.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right. Last week, as you know, maybe related. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. Anything could happen. Last week, we continued our series on the economics of inequality. We talked about working women, what has changed since women's workforce participation surged in the 90s, and then what has not changed for mothers trying to manage households and the sometimes inconsistent schedules at their job.
Great conversation with the amazing Emily Bazelon of the New York Times and Slate's Political Gabfest. Anyway, Samantha Johnson wrote in with her perspective. She and her husband are both doctors, and she says this. One thing that makes our arrangement work is that we don't have a quote-unquote power imbalance. That is, when he makes money, it's the family's, not his, to dole out, end of quote. But then she went on to say that when her husband tried to negotiate a higher salary, the reason for not giving it to him, she says, was that he would make too much more money than a female colleague, and that wouldn't be fair. And then Samantha says, why not raise women's salaries to match men and also not penalize single or single earner families? Yes, that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
That's I feel like so many issues are encapsulated in that one email that all we can say is like, yep.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Jen Wickman sent us this voice memo encouraging a more global perspective on the gender wage gap.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I just wanted to point out that Europe isn't perfect either when it comes to women in the workplace. Yes, they obviously have more generous parental leave policies than we do in the U.S., but in Denmark, for example, women still see a steep drop-off in earnings after having a child, and the long maternity leave allowed in many countries can mean women end up on a mommy track early on and don't necessarily get promoted into managerial positions. We obviously still need to improve a lot in the U.S., but I think it's important to acknowledge the unintended consequences of some of these more generous policies in Europe.
Yes, for sure. I had no idea, actually. It makes total sense, right, that happens on the pay scale stuff, but I had no idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we were talking about that, I didn't want to derail us completely, but I was in Denmark a few years ago, and I got a chance to meet with a bunch of female startup founders.
Oh.
And they were talking about that. It's essentially like, it's not just a generous family leave. It's essentially mandated that you take a year off. And all of these women were saying, I am delaying having a baby and I don't know what to do and I'm not sure I want to because I can't take a year off.
Wow.
And if I take a year off, my startup will die. And if I take a year off, I will, you know, be a year behind in skills.
Right.
And it was really interesting because that's exactly what they were talking about, how it's great, but you still have to make a huge trade-off in order to become a parent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought of that. Makes total sense. Of course. Of course. Of course. Of course. Okay. Time for the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but then found out you were wrong about?
This week, we're on trend. We're in the arc, the story arc. I love it when this happens. We're hearing from Marketplace reporter Scott Tong. Scott used to be our China bureau chief, and he actually wrote a book a couple years ago called A Village with My Name, which is all about his family story in China and the U.S. He also has reported all over the world, much of it on the sustainability beat. And I got to say, we've gone to him like a million times as we've been reporting out this series for Marketplace Tech, and he's always so helpful. He knows a ton. And this week, he told us about, in answer to this question, about a new way he learned to think about climate change.
One of the best images I have to understand climate change is a landfill. So stay with me here. Think of carbon pollution, everything that comes out of your car tailpipe and mine and power plants and planes and ships, as trash, environmental trash. All that trash has to go somewhere, the atmosphere. And what's really important to understanding climate change is the cumulative trash. All the CO2 emissions from me and my great-grandparents and all of that. Because emissions stay up there for hundreds of years, maybe forever. They add up. And the total emissions are what determines warming. The more overall trash, the hotter the Earth gets. Which brings us back to the landfill. That's the atmosphere. We can only dump so much before it's totally full. Because when warming hits 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit and it's full, things get really bad on Earth. So for one of my stories a couple years ago, a very nice climate scientist joined me on top of a stinky landfill in New Jersey, and he explained that the Earth's carbon landfill is half full right now, but we're emitting so quickly that we only have 11 years before it's totally full, so waste not.
There you go. Scott Tong.
Waste not, friends. Waste not. Scott is a guy who knows where he speaks. I love that he gave us like a radio show.
Yeah, and he's totally thoughtful about stuff too, which is super cool.
What is your answer to the Make Me Smart question, which once again is what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? You can send us your voice memos. We need some listener answers here.
Yeah, we
send
do,
them
actually.
In. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. I feel like it's been a long time since we heard from you, and we would like to.
Also, newsletter.
Newsletter. Newsletter.
Newsletter. Newsletter. Had a book recommendation for Emily Bazelon last week, an update on the streaming war, also a treatise on cowboy fashion, which I didn't even know that was, and now I know. There's a link to it in our show notes. Obviously, don't miss an issue. Subscribe at marketplace.org/newsletters. I got my pencils. Na, 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 na.
But I have my belt bag. Make Me Smart was produced and directed this week by Tony Wagner. Good job, Tony. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. We had production oversight from Jody Becker. And thank you to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore.
I still think the Make Me Smarter thing is kind of a fail, though. Can I just say that?
I'm just happy it's in parentheses. I was worried.
This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
We're going to take up the ER with Deborah Clark.
We are?
No.
We'll see what she says.
It was just a test. It was just a test.
I think she got us once, right?
And now I do kind of want the pencils,
she's
I admit.
Managing by fear. Yeah.
She's managing by fear.
Right.
It works.
Maybe.
It works.
You'll never know.
Uh.
I used to work with for somebody who was like, yeah, you have to like strategically freak out sometimes. It's like once in a while when nobody's expecting you, you just lose it. And it works.
That would not be terrible. Let me just say.
I was like, I mean, you know.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.